Welcome to Oncology Data Advisor, where we explore the latest advances in cancer research and patient care. Thanks for listening to this episode. Be sure to visit oncdata.com for more content, including expert perspectives from leading oncology thought leaders, FDA approvals, patient advocacy, and much more. And don't forget to subscribe to Oncology Data Advisor on social media to stay up to date on the latest videos, podcasts, and more.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this interview for AYA Cancer Week, which is going on this week from April 1st to 5th. Today, I'm joined by three of our editorial board members, Dr. Lauren Gazal, Megan Claire Chase, and Allison Rosen, who are all actively involved in advocating in this space. So we're really excited to hear their perspectives today. So with that, I will turn it over to you for the conversation.
Well, thanks for having us, Kira. And I was very excited to see that, you know, we have this platform and we have this opportunity to speak with other co-conspirators here who are real champions in the AYA space. And I think that, I mean, I think we'll probably each introduce ourselves a bit and I can start. So my name is Lauren Gazal. I come to this panel as an AYA myself. I was 26 when I was diagnosed with stage 2 Hodgkin lymphoma, and the timing, we all talk about the timing of cancer diagnosis in the AYA period, and mine just happened to be in my first year of my PhD program, where, you know, that's the foundations of learning how to do research, learning, you know, how to interact with patients and participants in clinical trials, to psychosocial work. And I was also working as a family nurse practitioner per diem as well. And so I quickly jumped from being in a patient room from that provider, being a nurse, to being a patient and then doing research. And I will say that my experience as an AYA patient completely shifted the trajectory of my program of research and my hat as being a researcher. And so I'm currently an assistant professor at the University of Rochester. Last summer, I hit my 5-year remission anniversary, which we talk about kind of all these milestones that you perhaps celebrate or don't as an AYA. And that just happened to also kind of go alongside my milestones in my academic career, which just allowed me to pause a lot and reflect on, okay, how am I envisioning a program of research that really keeps the AYA at the center of all of my work? And so a lot of my research work is in community engaged AYA cancer survivorship and really focusing on economic challenges. So around financial hardship and around employment challenges. So I'll pause there and probably pass it off to Megzy.
Yeah, so I am known as Warrior Megzy in cancer land, as I call it. And I remember when I first got diagnosed with stage 2A invasive lobular breast cancer, I was in my late 30s. In fact, it was 2 months after my 39th birthday. So I'm at the older end of the AYA age range. And I remember I kept being called young adult. And I was like, why am I being called a young adult? Like, it was very weird to me to hear that term until I learned about this whole underrepresented category that I was now part of and will always be part of. And for me, no one believed me. I wasn't even old enough yet still to even get a mammogram. You know, so it's like all of these tiny little things and major barriers of not being believed, being talked down to by a lot of the specialists because I knew something was wrong for over 2.5 years, and a lot of biases exist in the medical community. And that was what was happening to me. And I was not heard. And I really felt validated once I got the cancer diagnosis. Of course, it was still a shock. But it was like, I knew all this time something was wrong. You didn't do your jobs. And so once I got into this community of AYAs, I had my chemo twin. So shout out to Aaron. We still talk to this day. and didn't realize, wow, I went to that infusion room for my first chemo and I'm the youngest person in there. And also I looked really young too. And it just really hit me in that moment of, I don't belong here, yet I am here. Where's the support? Where are the people that look like me, not only in age range, but also racially?
Yeah. Well, so I will introduce myself. I'm Allison Rosen. I am a AYA colorectal cancer survivor. So everything you just said, and I 100% relate to. I was 32 when I was diagnosed. I was actually working in a cancer research lab. So I had the knowledge about cancer. I knew my family history. I had a lot of information, but yet I still got diagnosed. And in the clinic where I was treated, everyone thought my mom, who was my caregiver at the time, was the patient. And I really felt alone. And until I was actually introduced to other AYAs, adolescent, young adults, I know we've said that already, around my age, not necessarily my cancer type, I didn't realize that there was a community. There was a whole community that understood me. And through a fun, event at our zoo here in Houston, I just had real conversations with people that just understood all the struggles that I was going through. And I finally found my home. I found the support I needed. I found the friends that understood me better than my caregivers. Although there's a place, family and friends, amazing, but there's nothing better than another AYA that just understands you and can get all the struggles that you're going through that maybe your caregivers might not understand. And so the importance of this week is huge. To shine a light on that gap. We're not pediatric and we're not quite adult. There are unique issues that we as AYAs face. And I'll probably start off the conversation with talking about one that was important to me or is something I talk about openly, and that's fertility preservation and sexual health. Like I said, I was 32 when I was diagnosed and there wasn't a fertility specialist at the place I was treated. I asked, and that was because my friend said, Allison, ask, you're single. You want children, you should talk to your doctor about this. So I did. We had a whole conversation. I was going to freeze my eggs. I went outside of the institution to see somebody. I was going to freeze my eggs. And unfortunately, the day before that happened, I got really sick. Blood was, with disparaging details, blood was everywhere. And I had to forego that and go through my treatment. So it's something I'm super passionate about, talking about fertility preservation, because there's so many options. Four AYAs right now. And I think it's a conversation, no matter if you're 18, you're on that lower age, or you're in your 30s, 39, people need to have that conversation, that shared decision-making conversation with you, your spouse, yourself, even if you're, alone, about if you want children and family planning for the future. Even if you have children already as an AYA, a conversation still needs to happen. So I think fertility preservation and family planning are huge. And it's one of those things in AYA world that isn't often talked about. And it's a platform that again, I speak up often and hope first conversation when you're diagnosed is a part of that conversation.
Allison, I also speak about fertility preservation as well, because when I got diagnosed, I'm single. I think I'm chronically single really at this point. But I remember the first time I met my oncologist, she told me, and it was literally all in the same breath, okay, you're going to need 16 rounds of chemo. Do you want to freeze your eggs? So of course, all I heard within that like sentence was chemo and 16 rounds of chemo and my career. And oh my God, like I wasn't even thinking about like kids, what? Fertility preservation, what? And that's actually how I became like a research advocate, because I was a co-author of an abstract about AYAs and the fertility preservation and conversations with providers, because to this day, it just kills me that no one followed up like maybe a day after saying, hey, you heard a lot of information. I want to make sure that you're clear on what was said and what some potential next steps would be. And did I even have time? Was there a window for me to at least have a consultation? Because fertility preservation, like, it's still a lot of money. And especially as we think of AYAs and where you might be in your career, or you might still be in college or just starting out, or you may be like where I was. I wasn't where I wanted to be career-wise, and I really had crappy insurance. Though I was working for a really large media company, it was crappy insurance. And so my whole thought was like, financial, how am I gonna afford all this? And there was never like that follow-up conversation to say, okay, I know that you're single, you may not even be thinking about this, but at least have the conversation so you know your options. And to this day, it hurts me that that wasn't had. So I am very passionate about it as well.
Gosh, you each brought up so many things, and how we know fertility preservation. And now I'm seeing more of a push on really incorporating family planning and fertility restoration in those conversations, but how fertility preservation, family planning is like intrinsically linked to financial challenges, financial hardship. And then also considerations with like your family, you know, your supportive care partner, your partner. And then, you know, a lot of, for me, a lot of assumptions were made that, that I was in a straight relationship, that I, one, was in a relationship to begin with, and that I could easily just kind of access the supplies that you need to make an embryo within a few days. And then there was, you know, conversations then that had to be had with my provider, that, okay, it's going to look a little differently whenever I choose to start planning for a family. So I was 26, a diagnosis, as I mentioned. And, you know, I thought I had, Allison, you brought up working in cancer research, and you had that knowledge. I thought I had the knowledge. I studied economics before nursing. And, you know, I worked as a nurse practitioner at that point for a few years. And I thought I knew how healthcare systems worked, even like accessing your records. I thought I knew how to communicate with a friend. I thought I knew how to advocate for myself as a patient. And all that dramatically changed when I was diagnosed with cancer. I distinctly will remember running up. I was in New York City getting treatment, and I ran up First Ave with like physical slides from like a PET scan, I think it was, and then like my physical biopsy, like from a fine needle and I'm just like, we are in 2018. this should not be this painstakingly challenging, and it should not take going through your PhD and having a bachelor, and like it should not take that amount of knowledge just to be competent to be able to function in our system. So for me, that was my driving, like, that's what smacked me in the face in my PhD program to be like, you need to study this. You need to look closer at AYAs. We talked about how this week is AYA Cancer Awareness Week, and we have been saying, you know, AYAs are, we know that they're diagnosed between this, some time periods. I know different countries have different starting and end points, but we typically capture this as being diagnosed between 15 to 39 years. We know that there's been like an emergence of support, community-led support, advocacy organizations who really want to fully appreciate the unique experiences of AYAs. So I think coming to this, I had my question for both of you was going to be, you know, in your time in this community and having these experiences, has there been a resource that you feel like is undervalued and underappreciated that you wanted to take the time to amplify in a way, whether it's a community organization, whether it's a conversation that you've had with your provider, just were there moments or, you know, yeah, those organizations that have really stood out that you feel, you know, hasn't gotten the attention it deserves?
This is a great question. There are so many amazing organizations. I could probably talk for an hour. I will say that a view that I have utilized and really found 100% useful. Elephants and Tea is an amazing organization. I've written articles. They create this magazine. And I feel like the minute I read that magazine, I was like, wow, I related to almost every story in that. The magazine is a nonprofit. They do a lot of things, but they curate a magazine for AYAs each month that can be put in a clinic, can be mailed to you. And it's just stories. It's stories about various topics that are important for AYAs. They've done writing workshops. They've done all sorts of amazing things. That's one. Another one that I'm involved in and that I think also has amazing program is Teen Cancer America. They are focused on a lot of, I know I did a makeup class with them, with other AYAs, and it doesn't matter if you are where they live. Everything, a lot of their programming, Elephants and Tea and Teen Cancer America, is online. So you can access it on your computer. So both of those have been amazing. And then, you know, personally for colorectal cancer, there are a lot of good nonprofits, but I feel like three that I volunteer with on a regular basis, Fight Colorectal Cancer, Colorectal Cancer Alliance, and the Colon Cancer Coalition, all do amazing work in the colorectal cancer space and all have some sort of focus on early age onset. If it's research or if it's connections, or if it's programming, they all are amazing. And you can connect with other colorectal cancer survivors and patients and caregivers that are young as well. And again, I could go on and on, but those are three colorectal related and then like two of many AYA related organizations that have been vital in my survivorship.
And I second Elephants and Tea and Teen Cancer America. And I would also add Cactus Cancer Society. When I was going through my active treatment, they were actually called Lacuna Loft, but they changed their name years ago. And it's, for me, it's through writing. And with Elephants and Tea, like I just felt so like seen and heard because both Elephants and Tea and Cactus Cancer Society, with their writing programs that they have to help really process and heal. In fact, it was Cactus Cancer Society that published my very first piece because I'd taken one of their programs, Unspoken Ink. And it's so crazy that I never thought of myself as a writer. And now I call myself a writer because I couldn't believe, I was like, wait, what I have to say, you think others actually might want to like read it? And they're like, yeah, this is beautiful. And it was in that moment, it was like a shift in my head of, hey, what my experience is as an AYA, as a Black woman, as someone who lives in the South, because I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, and people wanted to hear what I had to say. And then when I had some stories published in Elephants and Tea magazine, I was like, what? Like, this is amazing. Like, what a great resource. And again, with Teen Cancer America, I have been really fortunate to give them some content on what it is like to be a Black AYA, because, you know, this week is AYA Awareness Month, but it is also the month of April is National Minority Health Month. And I would be, you know, it's been hard, I will say, because oftentimes when I do show up to AYA functions, whether it be online or if something is happening locally in the Atlanta area, I am often the only one that looks like me. And I feel like that is not talked about enough of, you know, how uncomfortable that can be, because not only have I gone through cancer, and I was originally diagnosed under 40. Now there's like, it's like I've aged out, which I really hate even saying that, but I'm still, it's like now I'm too old to be young, but I'm still too young to be like old, you know? And like, where do we fit in? But also I have added stressors that other, you know, my white counterparts do not have. And so a lot of times coming into these spaces where I am wanting that support, I do find, you know, friendships and support and everything, but sometimes it's like that people are just like, oh, let's talk about, you know, my favorite Disney movie and all that. And I'm like, okay, I'm thinking about the racism I just experienced. I wasn't served here, or, you know, the microaggression I might have experienced at work, or, you know, and how all of that factors into my healing, to other permanent damage and side effects that I still have, and other health issues, and how that added layer and not really being able to find the support I need for that specifically talks to the Black community has been hard, and I want to make sure that as much as we talk and say it's beautiful, the AYA and finding community, it is still hard to fully be seen as, you know, holistically with my identity as a Black AYA. Mm.
No, thank you for bringing that up. And I think about, you talk about layering, right? And we have, I think of theories of intersectionality, that it's like, you're not just an AYA, you're not just an AYA with cancer. You're not just a Black AYA with cancer, a Black queer AYA, like what you can add on these other really complicated layers that affect how you access a healthcare system, how society sees you, how, like, in an hour or what we have left, 30 minutes is not enough to break down these barriers. But it is an opportunity, again, to talk about that. NCI likes to say, right, we say, you know, one size doesn't fit all, or one size fits none in cancer survivorship. And the same thing holds true when you focus on a more narrow population with AYAs. Sure, there's less number-wise, but there's same amount of experiences, same amount of intersectional just lives that we have to take into consideration. I and then the one other thing I want to say, which is thinking about we know that there's also challenges to our community. And our, when I say our community, I mean AYA survivorship in general as a whole. But I think of, you know, this, there was not a real concerted effort to look at queer trans AYAs with cancer. And so ESCAPE, which is a grassroots organization,
yes,
you know, led by Haley Johnson and Yasmin and, you know, Elizabeth Dodd and some great folks. They were like, you know, we're going to do this needs assessment and we're going to build off of the AYA community and really have this authentic engagement and allyship and collaboration with existing AYA orgs. So it's not just a piece of, you know, TCA or a piece of Elephants and Tea, but we're going to, Haley partnered with Nick from Elephants and Tea to launch their needs assessment and really try to identify, okay, what were the specific needs of the LGBTQ or queer, the research world says sexual and gender minority, which is another thing. What are the unique needs of this population with AYAs? Also knowing that this is just a small percentage of our community. So I agree with you that there's still, you know, we're going to take this moment to, you know, celebrate and amplify this work, but then also hold in, you know, in our hearts that at the same time, there are still significant challenges and burdens that we face. And yeah, I don't know. Anyone else has reflections with?
I mean, I think for me, the AYA community, once I found it, I found home. Mm. And I think all the organizations that you mentioned all work together. Mm-hmm. There's some, in some advocacy spaces, there's a sense of competition. These guys, everybody, including mm-hmm. ones, organizations that weren't even mentioned, really care about the populations that they serve. So mm-hmm. no matter what their mission is, what their goal is, if there's an opportunity to collaborate, I've seen it firsthand. I know we've all seen it firsthand. They will, because they care. And I just think that it's huge, because someone newly diagnosed, sitting in a waiting room, looking around, thinking, feeling alone, which so many of us have felt, mm-hmm. Knowing that there is a home, there are organizations that we can go to for anything and everything, really makes such a difference. The first person I talked to, who was a young adult, I don't even remember her name, just made me feel like it was okay to not be okay. Like, I felt like I had to be strong because, you know, I was always, I've always had health issues and I've always put a strong front on. But really hearing someone say, it's okay to not be okay. You can go to the support group. People will understand you. You can cry. You can scream. You can do whatever you want to do, has gotten me where I am now as a 12-year survivor, helping to, you know, amplify all the voices within the community. Because I know I was privileged. I did go to an amazing cancer hospital. I did get the treatment I wanted. But my career shifted from research into community outreach and education, helping different communities that don't have access like I do. And I made myself the mission of for my life, career, advocacy, to help bridge the gap between healthcare providers and the communities that they serve. And if I'm not the right voice or the right person, I make sure I help find that person, because I'm not always the right person. Like, you, the three of us are amazing advocates, but the whole community, it's great because someone will reach out and say, Allison, do you know someone here with this cancer, or this age, or this mutation, or this whatever? And I'll be like, I will find them for you. And it's such a welcoming community that people reach. I mean, I'm sure, just like I'm sure you guys, same as me, every day we get messages from people. I have a friend that was recently diagnosed. They don't know where to turn. They don't know what resources are available. And resources are huge, huge. But just, again, just the sense of community. Once I found the AYA community, I could talk about all the challenges during treatment and now as a survivor that I was so missing. Physical health, doctors, great. You can help, you know, do this surgery, do this radiation, do this chemo. But the mental aspect of it is a whole, you could talk about that for like 2 hours. But I think the sense of community within AYA is these organizations and so many more really help you find a home and help you feel like you're not alone.
You know, lately I've been struggling with that word of like, you know, oh, I found a home. And it's like, I don't like to say, oh, I found a home where I found my family, because that just doesn't sit. Those aren't the words for me that I like to use. What I like to say is, you know, I have found very specific people at very specific AYA organizations who want to be, they want to hear what I have to say. They are willing to get uncomfortable and have those uncomfortable conversations. But I do wish more would be willing to do that. Because it is very hard. A lot of times I have to censor myself, and I sometimes have to be quiet in some of these AYA spaces, and no one ever reaches out after to say, hey, that might've been a lot and there wasn't really space for you to say anything. Are you okay? And that is something I really want in this AYA week of amplifying resources and the support is, you know, when someone of color does show up online to one of the virtual groups, or if there's something in person that you have and they show up, why is no one following up with these people? Because I'll come back like the next week and I don't see that person. And I feel like, again, if we're gonna say that this is a family, AYA family, home, community, well, then where's the follow-up? And it really angers me because I actually have kind of dropped out of a lot of AYA things, of going to like programs, because no one ever bothered to say, hey, are you okay? Hey, what's it like to be the only face that looks like yours in a screen of like 30 people? Like, I feel like no one really wants to have those kind of conversations and be uncomfortable. So it's like now I no longer feel seen, and I'm almost understanding why there's a need to segregate and find Black only support, which is something I never would have even thought about or considered when I was originally going through my active treatment. And now that I've been in post-treatment and survivorship, quote unquote, as I like to say, my longest relationship has been with no evidence of disease, Ned, is I'm still looking for my community, and I never thought I would have to segregate myself in order to find it, because that just seems absurd to me. When we are in 2024, how can we not be more collectively working together? But also, where's the follow-up? Like, I feel like many of the AYA organizations are not doing, they're not doing a good enough job, and I see it. And as someone who is very, very vocal about this, and it's like they're not coming to me as often, because now I'm questioning, I'm pushing back, because before I was so grateful just to find like Allison and Lauren, like, you know, just to even find people that were like my age and stuff like that. But then once I got into a better place mentally and emotionally, somewhat physically, can still deal with some issues. I then start to realize, wait, I actually need more. I need different kind of conversations to feel like I'm getting the support. And so I never thought in a million years I would be like, say race is not, why isn't it part of this conversation? Because it really needs to be. Mm-hmm.
In hearing you speak, Megzie, I think of this oncologist that wrote Seasons of Survivorship. And I think about, like, there are different points of our survivorship or our trajectory where, you know, we sometimes don't know that we're going to need that. Like, I think of mental health as a big example. And like, Allison, you had mentioned before, like, you know, your physicians, your doctors, like, checkbox physical stuff. Yes, like they can. And then it's like, you never know sometimes when it could be, you know, you're halfway through that treatment and all of a sudden you're, for me, it was like, I remember taking the train and that was the first time where I was like, oh, it's hitting me and I am feeling overwhelmed right now. And I don't know if I have the tools ready in my toolkit of like me to address this because I was holding back from my therapist that I started seeing from the beginning, but it was like, I wasn't ready to go there yet. I was still traumatized by the whole aspect. And then I think about like my interactions with community groups and with support that whether it's through services, whether it's through informational material that has kind of exploded in a sense and there's a lot there, but then it's like just being aware of that and accessing that and how that has also changed throughout my survivorship trajectory. And it's, you just bring up such a great, like, point of reflection, Megzie, and, you know, with separating something based on whether it's your race and ethnicity, whether it's your religion, whether it is your, you know, we see even, you know, parents of young children who are AYAs, whatever identity, physical or not, whether it's disability status, you know, is that further, you know, perpetuating perhaps health and healthcare disparities in AYAs, or is that actually like meeting a real need of AYAs in actually seeing you as you are? And for me, when I think about like accessing escape resources, it's kind of like, there's a little bit more relief that I have that it's like, I don't have to explain so much this part of my identity when I'm here as an AYA. It's like, they already get that.
Yeah.
And that's like this. So I don't know. I'm trying to say this in a visual way. Like, it's kind of like when you're layering different things and then that one, you can just kind of leave at the door. That hat, you can just be like, okay, maybe I can, I don't know if it has to do with comfort. I don't know, but this is just something I've been reflecting on more and more. And it's like, we want to try to find these tailored, individualized, whether it's like post-treatment survivorship care plans, but then also really trying to look at AYAs as a whole and mm-hmm. as a population, that it's like, how do we do this when each and every AYA is so unique?
It's tough. It's mm-hmm. tough. I mean, for me, it was trying to find, there's a stigma related to colorectal cancer. People don't want to talk about it. Younger people don't want to talk about it. And in I was just doing policy work in DC to advocate for more funding, being figure out why. Because like, I can tell my story all day long. Younger people diagnosed with colorectal cancer can tell their story all day long. But if we don't know why, then, and we're telling younger people, okay, if you have these signs and symptoms, or if you have this or you're that, go talk to your doctor about screening. If the doctors aren't going to screen them, or like, we're doing a lot in our collective spaces, but there's always room to do more. And I think we need more people like Megzie that will speak up. If something's missing, where is it? Where can I find it? Because there's always room to create something new. You know, there's organizations, again, that do great things, but if you haven't found your home, that's fine. I think we all want people to feel comfortable with, again, their sexual orientation, their race, their ethnicity, their religion. So I'm Jewish, and you're at higher risk if you're Ashkenazi Jew to get colorectal cancer. I don't think I've met anyone else Jewish that has colorectal cancer. So like, it's just like, I've my community is young adult colorectal cancer survivors. I know there are younger, you know, women and men that are Jewish. And I spoke at my mom's Hadassah group, much older women, obviously. And they're like, oh, well, maybe I should talk to my kids about this. And I'm like, yeah, you probably should. You know, they're like, I didn't even know that we're at higher risk for this or that. And, you know, I'm not necessarily going to create another group at any point, but I think there are certain things that we need to be comfortable speaking up about that are missing, because someone else feels the same exact way that you do. And that's as simple as, you know, again, sitting in the waiting room, being the only young person with your type of cancer, but it's also sometimes more specific than that. And, you know, I think that, again, there's a lot being done. I know when I was going through treatment 12 years ago, there's no AYA Awareness Week, that's for sure.
Right?
No conversation around any of this stuff. So, I mean, I think my heart is happy that progress has been made, but there's always room for more. There's always growth, and there's always needed conversations to happen. I think why this is so important, this conversation is so important. We all are very different. We're all very alike. And we all find we need resources that might be different and some might be alike, but we need to empower everyone within our community to help find what they need. And if it doesn't exist, let's help create it.
And you bring up another point about health literacy. And I had a discussion with a fellow AYA in the breast cancer community a couple of weeks ago. And we were talking about that, you know, whether you were in your late teens to early 20s, and then in your 30s, like, how, like, did you know, like, what deductibles meant? Did you know, like, to ask for financial help or financial navigator or a nurse navigator, like, all of these terms too? And then it's like, when I break it down even more, I think of the different cultures. And I think, you know, the similarities of like Black and like Latino, like Latinx, Hispanic cultures, Asian cultures, where we're taught to just accept what the doctors say instead of questioning. And so I have really made it like another mission to talk to young women, men, and those who identify as they, them, to say, you know what, it's your patient right to ask questions. It's your patient right to get pushy, and it's your patient right to change doctors, because going through this experience when you're already young, and then you have other factors that make it sometimes difficult or feel uncomfortable to speak up in the moment with a doctor, or you're feeling like, I don't think this doctor is hearing me, or they've actually, you know, said something that you are taking as a microaggression, and they might not even realize it. I will say that sometimes they really don't know what they don't know. But it's also making sure that we're getting through to young people now and saying, hey, we know in our cultures, we normally don't do this, but your health is yours and you matter. And if you don't speak up, and you have to teach others like the different elements of advocacy, because all of us, we're vocal, right? Like, put me in front of a microphone, right? But not everyone is like that. And not everyone needs to be like that. And so it's really like helping right now elevate the AYA community by saying, you know, here are things you can do. Here are different ways you can advocate for yourself without having to like really put yourself out there. It's tiny little things of saying, it's your patient right to ask questions. If you don't feel comfortable with that doctor, they're making you feel uncomfortable. You can change. And here is how. So I wish, coming up with all kinds of ideas here, but like, we really need to talk more about that health literacy. Because I think that is a really missing key component, because we're so focused on in the AYA community of like, if you're in college or working or just starting out in your career, making a career change, and how a cancer diagnosis totally changes that trajectory. And you're starting to realize just how important insurance is and what kind of insurance you have, what's covered, what's not covered. And I feel very strongly about making sure that we're helping to educate future AYAs.
Well, I just looked at down at my calendar and it's April 1st. And so I said, I was like, oh, you know, I posted on Twitter X this morning, like happy AYA awareness. And I was like, oh, I should follow up that this is not an April Fool's joke. Like similar to, it's like, you know, it's not an April Fool's joke. And it's actually real that nearly 90,000 AYAs are diagnosed each year. And that number, unfortunately, is going up. But at the same time, we have AYAs living longer than ever before. So I think the reality is, you know, we're having an increasingly diverse population of AYAs living longer than ever before, like engaging in, you know, work longer than ever before, engaging in, you know, their careers. And so I think that a conversation like this kind of sets the ground for a whole future. It could be a whole body of research for someone too, but really, you know, sets the foundation for why it is important that we have moments like this to talk and to kind of recap on. And there were so many things that I was like, had in my mind that I'm like, ah, oh, it's like, you know, we talk about AYA stuff. We talk about advocacy. There's this whole thing on like fatigue and advocacy and how each of us probably encountered that moment where you're sharing your story and you've done it many times and then all of a sudden something hits you in a way that it hasn't before, or you know, you kind of say it in a way that's like you've said it 100 of times before. And
yeah,
were there any like final thoughts that you all had with just being AYA Awareness Week? I know there's been a push from some organizations who want to make it a month. But I think in the work that each of us do respectively, it's year in, year out. But yeah, any closing thoughts that we have?
Oh, geez. I mean, again, and it could be this is an amazing conversation. I think with this week, it's about awareness, spreading awareness beyond the groups that we're involved in. So trying to make sure that everyone within the community hears this message. We know it. We talk about it. We live, breathe, eat it. I think ensuring that others within the community know that if something seems wrong, it might be wrong and they can speak up. I think my whole platform, so many things are I'm passionate about, but one of the biggest thing is you are your own best advocate. And if anything comes out of this week, you know, AYAs, we are, you know, loud and in a good way, but I want other people to realize that they're not alone. But also they are their own best advocate and there are resources out there for them if they think something's wrong, even before something might be wrong. So that's really my closing thing is we've done some amazing work in the space. We have a lot more to do, but I want to empower anyone out there that might be listening that thinks something might be wrong to please talk to their doctor. And if that doctor doesn't listen, please talk to another one until someone finds out what is going on with you. It might not be cancer, but you are your own best advocate.
1000%, Allison. Yes, you know, it's trusting your gut. Because if I had just given up, I spent over 2.5 years of having strange symptoms. And they just kept, you know, saying, oh, you just need to lose weight and eat better. I'm like, the whole point is that I'm gaining weight. What's going on? The whole point is this. The whole point is that. And not being believed. But I kept pushing because what I want everyone to remember is you matter. And if, again, you know, as Allison said, if you aren't feeling comfortable, then go to someone else. Like, but trust your gut that when you know something is not right in your body or you're feeling some kind of way, don't discount it because doctors are saying, you know, giving you the runaround. You keep pushing because you matter. And no one else is going to speak up for you or know exactly what is going on with you, except for you. And it's finding the different ways that you feel comfortable and pushing forward, but also too, is about that mental health component. I know we kind of mentioned that a little bit earlier, but it's like, it is okay to not be okay. And more importantly, once you end up getting that diagnosis, whether it be cancer or another chronic illness, and you are still in, you know, AYA, it is hard to live with. And maybe you had therapy before a diagnosis. You're going to need a whole other set of coping skills to add in your toolkit. And that was something I realized. So my personal advocacy, aside from, you know, talking about the racism found within these spaces, and, you know, speaking up for yourself, is also that mental health component of, at the end of the day, this is going to be a lot, and you're going to be in that fight or flight mode for a while. But then once you're ready to start the path of processing all that you have been through, don't ever question those feelings or discount those feelings, and seek, you know, an AYA community and people out there that you feel comfortable with. And we are out there. It just, you know, and there are a lot more resources than, you know, when we were originally diagnosed, and that is fantastic. But again, there's still more work to do, more policy changes that need to be had, and more uncomfortable conversations that need to be had.
That, I think, is a great way to end this discussion. I could talk to you both for a while more. I really loved capitalizing on those two main points. And yeah, I just want to thank you. Thank you, Kira, and the team for inviting us.
Yes.
Thank you for continuing to, you know, amplify our work in our respective spaces, for inviting us back, and for, you know, Oncology Data Advisor for really supporting us too.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Of course. We're so glad to have the three of you on the board so that we can have these conversations. So thank you all so much for such a wonderful discussion. I'm so glad we were able to bring up all these points.